Never would we forget him.
Oh, no.
Mr. Dave Zanotti from the American Policy Roundtable. Mr. Zanotti, how are you, sir?
Unforgettable.
Unforgettable.
I knew you'd break into Nat King Cole right there.
Well, you know, you set it up so well for us.
The multi-genre talent.
Yes.
Tommy and Jeff, right here on the SFL.
Yeah. All right. Well, we are full swing in a new administration. What are you seeing so far?
And the chuckle. Get ready, everybody.
What I'm seeing is the equivalent of the question that was asked to Mr. T in Rocky III on what his predictions were for the battle ahead, and he simply looked at them and said, pain. And he says, that's what we're experiencing. Profound amount of pain. Unless we're anesthetized and refuse to in any way, shape, or form look at it. But the inaugural address, I think, was most interesting and certainly enlightening in regards to the philosophical approach that this administration would take towards America as a people. So it was a very interesting address and an interesting approach, and everything that's followed was ethically and consistently from that vision, from what Joe Biden basically gave to us, which is that America is now a democracy. It's no longer a republic. It is a democracy. And a democracy, we have moved to a nation of majoritarian rule, and the fastest way to move forward is for everyone to simply accept majority thought and conform to the majority thought, and then we can do great things together.
Dave, tell us first about what you do so people know what perspective you are coming from when you share your thoughts.
We are called as missionaries to America to bring biblical truth into the arena of media and public policy. We've been doing that for 41 years. We do it from a platform of being politically independent. We don't take any money from candidates. We don't endorse candidates. We not only do not endorse political parties, we are no fans of them. We believe that the truth propositions presented in the Declaration and the Constitution flow from a biblical form, and that to the degree that we understand principles, teach them, and attempt to live them out, we have the greatest form, or the greatest opportunity to experience freedom and form under the rule of law, and that that's the message of history. So this is what we do every day. We teach America every day, not the contemporary version, but the version of what America is in its founding definitions, and then try to apply those definitions to the contemporary version.
Well, how can we change from a constitutional republic to a democracy?
We do it by systematically forgetting what we were and then accepting a very careful transfer of words to where we make the words democracy and republic synonymous and say, well, they both mean the same thing. But now they do, because they're interchanged constantly. And it was for years they were simply interchanged in same sentences or paragraphs or documents without any contrast of the definitions. And now the word republic is basically disappearing. President Biden in his speech used the word 11 times and made only one reference to the word republic. He used the word democracy 5 times in his first 6 sentences. Now, why is that important? Well, an inaugural address, particularly in a new administration, is setting up a philosophical proposition on where the executive branch is going. These addresses are very important. We've only had 46 presidents, and they've all had initial inaugural addresses, and we study them, and they are substantive. So this is a very significant philosophical statement that was written by an Indian American whose parents came here from India, who happened to be a lawyer, has a law degree from Ohio State University, young man, a first generation born in America of his family. He wrote the speech, but the speech parallels almost identically in language to a statement that was released the very same day by John Podesta, the founder of the Center for American Progress, which is the most influential left-wing progressive think tank in America. Podesta's statement on the morning of the inaugural day virtually paralleled the president's inaugural address. So these thoughts are coming from somewhere. There's a team. And this, of course, is predictable. I mean, presidents don't write their own speeches most of the time. And there's a team of thought that is really the platform that is driving this administration, as there is in every administration. So we analyze those thought forms and those groups to try to understand what to expect and how it fits.
So, Dave,
one thing you said is that whatever the majority thinks, we're going to go for the majority and as quickly as we can. But I would argue even much of what he's done doesn't even have majority support. The transgender bill that he signed, the abortion laws that he signed, do not have majority support in our country. I'm not even sure things like canceling the Keystone Pipeline and other things have majority support. I don't even think we're going to a democracy. You know, I think it's more, you know, mob rule or you know, who's the loudest partisan voice. And that's becoming what's being pushed.
Well, that's, again, as I said, it's a very insightful question because it shows how majoritarianism is in the eye of the beholder.
Ah.
And what happens is our presidential worship syndrome that really took over this country in the 1960s, combined with majoritarianism, makes it that if you win the presidency, you win everything. And you do whatever you want to do until everybody else catches up with you. That's majoritarianism. And basically, when you ask that question, say, well, excuse me, Mr. President, or Mr. Speaker of the House, or Mr. President of the Senate, the majority of Americans don't want to become energy dependent again. They want the Keystone Pipeline. They would say, well, elections have consequences. And the president won, and so he's now got the power. Now, our founders designed a system of checks and balances so we could be able to go to the House and the Senate and to override executive decisions that do not reflect the will of the people. But what we've done is with television and our worship of the presidency, we've made it a big prize. And it's easier that way. All this stuff about voting for state reps and state senators and governors and congress people and senators, my gosh, that takes a lot of work and I got to go more often. If I just vote for the big guy, he'll take care of it. That's what's happened. So we have majoritarianism now in an administrative state headed by an executive or maybe an executive committee, but it's controlled by the people who win the big one. That's the worst kind of majoritarianism.
Well, because, you know, in a constitutional republic, one of the things the Constitution does is it says there's certain things you don't get to vote on, right? There's certain things, certain rights that people have that, you know, if the majority of the people think you shouldn't be allowed to say this or you shouldn't be allowed to worship in this way or do this, too bad, right? These are rights you don't get to vote on. There are some things that you know, kind of off limits to that. And when we erode that, suddenly those rights and those liberties get eroded as well.
This is exactly what we're dealing with right now. And this is a very grave problem. We're talking about it a lot on the public square, and it's important to note, we're talking about it for 41 years. This is not a reaction to who won the presidency, because we don't actually think the person who wins the presidency is that big a deal. We are far more concerned about the people who control Article 1, which is the federal legislature, which is Congress. That is the far, far, far more important group than who wins the presidency. But our country is addicted to literally a presidential form of worship. We call it presidential worship syndrome. And so what happens is we come out every 4 years elected champion and then see you later. And that just doesn't work. Now, again, we see that people eventually catch on to this and catch it. It takes time, and a lot of damage can be done until we restore balance in the system.
And it seems like a system that's deeply broken. Senator Rob Portman from Ohio just announced that he will not be running for re-election. And one of the things he said I thought was really insightful and also concerning. You know, he was tired. I'm going to paraphrase his comments here, but he said he's tired. He said, basically, if you want to run for Senate and you want to go on the TV talk shows and yell and scream and argue, he goes, you can do that. But if you want to come here and actually get something done or pursue substantive legislation, he goes, this isn't the place to do it. And he's just tired of playing the game. And I thought that was concerning because it's basically admitting, you know what, the system is just broken down.
Well, I have to tell you that we've been Portman's career for its entirety. If you ask most people in Ohio, who's Rob Portman and where's he from? They can't tell you who he is or where he's from. He's been the typical disappearing senator who for two terms, 12 years, has taken a big paycheck in the Club of 100 and had a wonderful lifestyle and accomplished nothing, not because of the hostile environment of the Congress, but because he's very ineffective as a leader. And that's just reality. He is ambiguous in his positions. He exhibits very little effort. He doesn't stand for much of anything except to get along with the Club of 100. And he's become a consummate Washington insider. So people like that can't say, gee, I've got my pension. I've got my paycheck. I can go retire now. I serve my time and everyone will respect me
and I got a great life ahead of me, and I didn't really care that much anyhow, because then we would think ill of him. So he blames everybody else. And that's disgusting. And I find it despicable. And Ohio has to do better than that when they pick a new senator. And this is not unique to Rob Portman. We've seen people do this over and over and over again. Senate Club of 100 is one of the most despicable groups of leaders in the history of this country. Someone comes in and actually takes a stand on issues, takes a stand for the Constitution, takes a stand for life and the preservation of life in the United States Senate. They are summarily dismissed and chastised by the leadership, Republican and Democrats, because they don't understand the Senate. The Senate is a place where we're cool, calm, collected, and just get along. And it's a tremendous conspiracy of this Club of 100. I've spent my entire life studying them. I can remember my first interviews with senators, and I don't get many anymore because I'm not afraid to ask them the tough questions. Like, why don't you do something instead of just complaining about things? And that's why I never get invited back. So my personal opinion, I completely reject what Rod Portman said. It's the standard line of an establishment politician who wants to cover his tracks for accomplishing nothing what he promised the people of his state.
Let me take it back one step then. Under the Constitution and the system of checks and balances, if it were working properly, how would that look? What would the House look like? What would activities of the Senate look like? And what would the role of the presidency look like in a properly functioning constitutional system with checks and balances? Kind of just briefly walk us through that.
Beautiful question. To know that, we have to read the Constitution, which doesn't take but a half an hour, start to finish, and maybe not even that long. And then we have to look to the notes of the Constitution from Madison, and then the arguments that were made by the defenders of the Constitution in the Federalist Papers. What you find, and I can make this very quick, the single greatest source of power in our system of government is supposed to be the United States House of Representatives. It is called a vortex of power by the framers in the Federalist Papers. That is to be where all the action is, and that's why they're elected every 2 years, and because they're so powerful, you have to keep them under constant accountability. The Senate acts as an additional legislative body to continue to drive balance between the House and the Senate. That is where all the power is in the legislative branch. The executive executes these matters in regards to whatever administrative state responsibilities are given to the executive branch by the Congress, but Congress needs to have a much greater role of oversight, not just on funding, but on the day-to-day practice of an overbloated bureaucracy. And the courts are designed simply to act as an appellate vestige when states get into trouble with one another or people run into serious problems regarding their rights as it regards to state and federal processes. Number one is Article One, the most powerful. Number two, the executive branch is second. And number third, the least powerful is to be the courts. Often in our country today, that process is completely upside down. And those branches are not co-equal. They do serve to check one another on accountability, but the most powerful measure is the legislative body. And the same thing translates to the states.
Can you explain more the executive order? Because I've read something, I think it was Reagan and Clinton did none. And it started with President Bush and then just started accelerating from there, or it started with Obama. I can't remember.
Well, it's been around for a long time, but it accelerated through those administrations, as you mentioned, because the president does not want to go through the laborious process of making laws through the legislature. So he makes laws from his desk and dares the legislature to catch up with him. It's the same thing the court does. The court decides they're going to rule on a political matter or a matter of law, legislate from the bench, and dare Congress to catch up with them. In both instances, the Congress could override an executive order in a day or a Supreme Court decision as well. The Constitution affords them that authority, but because we have cowards who hold positions in our legislative body who don't want to read the Constitution and take on the balance of power responsibilities because they don't want to be chastised on cable news and on network news, and they don't want to lose their postings on Facebook, they simply go along for the ride. We need constitutionalists in Congress, not who will be radicals, but who simply be constitutionalists and say, I'm sorry, we have a job to do, and we're going to do it. It's that simple. For example, the president passes an executive order on the Keystone Pipeline that impacts all of our foreign policy, all of our energy policy. Congress simply calls a measure to the floor saying, we're not going to accept the cancellation of the Keystone Pipeline, period. End of conversation. We're voting on it. The president's been, oh, his executive order is null and void because we're passing a law. And a presidential order is not a law. It's a temporary law at best. And we're not only challenging it, we're overcoming it. It's that simple. They could fix it in a day. Why don't they? Because we're a majoritarian country. They believe that if you win the presidency, the Congress just needs to shut up and go away. Well, that's ridiculous. That's absurd.
It doesn't mean all opposition stops just because you won the presidency and that all power is vested in him. But going back to what you said, and I think from a as a church perspective, as a Christian, and as Christians approaching this, and this is one thing that concerns me deeply about the church, is the worship of the president. You know, maybe we shouldn't be surprised yeah. that happens in a wider culture, in a godless culture, because if you're a godless person, you're going to find something to fill that void, right? We know that. But that void's supposed to be filled for us in the church, right? I mean, we have a Savior. We have a God. And the amount of worshipfulness that we've seen, especially in the last two presidencies, the Obama presidency and the Trump presidency, from the church is deeply concerning as a Christian leader, as a pastor.
It's tragic, but it didn't begin in this election. You can go back to people who worshiped John Fitzgerald Kennedy before he was assassinated. With the rise of popular television and live film and now digital transmission, the presidency has become, in essence, its own TV show. And we have a media addiction and saturation to a leader. We've shifted our personal responsibilities onto him the same way that Israel did in 1 Samuel chapter 8. They said, give us a king to fight our battles for us. Then we'll be like everybody else, and we can go do our thing, and this guy can fight for us. We have turned the presidency into a champion, and now we've turned it into a vicarious fight. And it's wrong at every level. We call it presidential worship syndrome. I don't care which candidate of the many that ran for president. There weren't just two. At any point in time, we're putting our trust in a man, we're worshiping a man or a woman, we're focusing on a candidate, we are making a phenomenal mistake. We are a republic of a rule of laws, not of men. And we're heading in the wrong direction, and we have. And it's a part of our saturation in media, and I apologize. I wish I was more noble, and maybe in 10 years I'll mellow out. But I'm really sick and tired of people who complain about our government but don't take their responsibilities for self-government, which is what this entire premise is built upon. You can't be free if you're not willing to govern yourself and then to participate in the process. You can't elect champions or parties for you. Mm-hmm. We have to elect people to represent us and send them into government and then hold them accountable. And that's hard work, and we are all spoiled and lazy, because we've experienced the blessings of America without the sacrifice. Yeah. And like trust fund babies, we've all got that attitude. And we've got to change.
And I think as Christians, we need to realize we already have a champion in Jesus Christ. We don't need to elect one.
Pastor, I'll tell you, persecution isn't coming. It's here.
Yeah.
People are facing every single day now being canceled, being silenced, being fired, because they are expressing opinions, not about Trump and Biden. That's not significant at all in this conversation. They're expressing comments about truth versus error.
Dave, it's going to get harder to be a Christian, not easier. And we need to ready ourselves for that and decide where we're going to stand. And are we going to walk the hard path, or are we going to take the easy road?
And I will tell you, the great hope is this. Our boss has risen from the dead.
Amen.
We have to decide to walk in the light and the strength and the power of his spirit, which is the resurrection power, and trust him for the difference. That's the way America got started. And we can find that path again. We haven't given up hope, but we desperately need to repent and seek God and ask him to change us.
Real quick, I mean, you mentioned we're just kind of lazy. We need to infiltrate the culture. And I think that's how the government's gotten this way, is we haven't gone into government ourselves. We're not infiltrating the culture. We're just living comfortably in our own little homes and churches and acting out there.
That's really, and there's a lot of reasons for that, Jeff. We talk about that together on a regular basis. I won't drag you guys through that all this morning. You've been so gracious with your time. But you couldn't be more right. Here's the big difference. The difference between walking this versus reacting to it is the goal of the Great Commission is accomplished through the Great Commandment that we love our neighbor as we love ourselves. We love God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love our neighbor as we love ourselves. Loving our neighbor is a call of service, and there is no greater service than the service of civil government. This is the tough stuff. If I love my neighbor, I care about his garbage being picked up on time. I care about his heat and water and his access to health care. I care about these things. Now, it's not all that I care about, but I care about his eternal soul, his eternal death. But I also care about our children being taught the truth with the schools that I'm paying for. It's not just particulars. I don't get to pick and choose. Jesus Christ is Lord of all. And I'm called to love God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love my neighbor as myself. Public service is a part of love of neighbor, and that's the difference.
We're talking with Dave Zanotti from the American Policy Roundtable, the Public Square, iVoters. I mean, you got toes in the water everywhere.
Busy man.
Yes. So, Dave, tell
us. All for us.
Yes.
All to help us.
Where's the best place to go to get access to all those areas?
Thepublicsquare.com. That's where you'll find our communications projects that we send out in media every single day at thepublicsquare.com. And then from there, you'll find your way to our different websites and our different products. And thank you, Jeff, for noticing that this is all done from a nonprofit basis. It's all done as a work of service. We're not carrying the water for any candidates. We're not carrying the waters for any heroes. Our boss is risen from the dead, and he makes all the difference.
Amen. Dave, thanks so much.
Thank
it's
you.
Always invigorating talking to you. I missed you last time. I was sick, you know. I had to.
I'm glad you're better.
And
thank you, guys. A great compliment to be on your program. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben. Have a great day. God bless, brother.
Keep up the good work.
See you now.